Hello and welcome to the first symposium of the Lotus Eaters, where we are going to engage in a number of philosophical discussions. I'm joined today by Carl.
Hello.
And we are going to discuss about wisdom and its disappearance. So an interesting thing to note is that one of the go-to places when we start talking about a philosophical concept is Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which has interesting entries and has really good bibliographical sections. The entry on wisdom has only 19 sources, most of which are not contemporary. If you put philosophy of dance, you will see 10 and a half pages of bibliography. So it seems that wisdom isn't discussed very much.
Where do you ever see anyone other than someone like Peter Hitchens discussing something like wisdom in the public space?
It is considered to be, I don't know, a cliche or an outdated concept.
Yeah, we're moderns now. We've transcended wisdom.
Yes.
You know, we've mathematically calculated the correct answer. So what could wisdom possibly have to teach us?
I think it's interesting that you use the word modern, because I think that modernity and modern philosophy is behind the disappearance of wisdom.
I agree.
And I think that it would be very interesting if we started by looking at the concept of wisdom and what kinds of things people who use it try to capture with it, and then try to create to lead ourselves into a broader discussion as to what are the cultural reasons why people don't care about wisdom anymore, or at least they do not think about wisdom in the way they did.
I think that's a really good point. They just don't care about wisdom, do they?
Yes. It is portrayed as something that is almost paternalistic, because it is very much connected with the idea of a wisdom tradition, which involves a body of beliefs passed from one generation to the next. And this does seem to rest upon the idea of old people with experience who have some knowledge of life that younger people don't have, and they pass it on to younger generations.
Yes.
And nowadays, egalitarian sentiments in academia and the popular culture are entirely hostile to such an asymmetry of knowledge and experience.
Yeah. So the way this entered into my method of thinking was from reading Michael Oakeshott's Rationalism in Politics. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but like,
yes,
he breaks knowledge down into essentially two categories: the technical knowledge, which can be learned rationally and read from a book, and practical knowledge, which is something you can only learn by doing.
Yes.
A good example of this is, say, woodworking, something like that. Okay, how much pressure do you need to put down? Well, I mean, they could tell you in a book you need X amount of, you know, PSI of pressure or something like that, but you don't really know what that feels like until you're doing it. And then you pick up the feel of the thing, and it's probably the same with any kind of practical ability like that. And wisdom, I think, is the aggregation of these the things that have been learned through direct practical experience that can't really be distilled down into a body of technical knowledge. As in, you can't really write down what wisdom is and then expect people to rote learn it and then expect them to gain the benefits of it. They kind of have to watch wisdom in process, in practice. And another important part that Oakeshott would bring up about wisdom is that time therefore becomes a component of knowledge. So to have done something for a period of time is required before you can gain the practical knowledge of it. Unlike, for example, anything in a book. You know, you could read a line in a book, right? It took me virtually no time to learn it, and now I know that essentially forever. This is, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. I only need to learn that once, and then it's done forever. But practical knowledge, and therefore wisdom, is not the same. And it's an ongoing process. And like you say, it builds up a kind of tradition that you learn by doing alongside someone who is what I guess we could call a master of the tradition. And this is an entirely different body of knowledge that has no credence in our societies at this point. I think that we lose a lot for that.
We do. And it's interesting, because if we go back to Aristotle, we will see a notion of wisdom as skill, which is one of the things that philosophers have tried to capture with a notion of wisdom. So we could talk about a wise trader, or a wise craftsman, or a wise architect. And this is used as an honorific. It's a term that we use to describe excellent practitioners in their field. But I agree with you. As you say, it is not the only way to talk about wisdom. And it is not just that. And the modern world does lead us into thinking that the only notion of wisdom that is relevant to our lives is that of skill.
Yeah.
And we will go to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we will definitely visit Oakeshott's discussion of rationalism and politics. Okay. But let us first try to see the Western tradition, some key people in the Western tradition of wisdom, and let us see how they dealt with it, why they were considered wise.
Okay.
So we have, for instance, the tradition, we have, it again, it starts with the idea of a wisdom tradition.
Hmm.
One of the most interesting poets in ancient Greece was Hesiod.
Mm-hmm.
And Hesiod in Works and Days, he is considered to be a wise poet and sort of instructor, someone who gives ethical instructions. And it's interesting because if we look at it, he gives instructions that we would consider to be entirely mundane, such as to how to plow a field.
That's very interesting, actually. Because I was thinking of Homer when you were saying that, because obviously Homer, containing the moral imperatives that instructed classical Greece on how they should live their lives and what a good and heroic life was. But I wasn't thinking of Hesiod's mundane instructions. But then I'm instantly brought to mind that actually, if you think, like, it never really occurred to me, but on the other side of this, you've got the sort of the poets who are the teachers of Greece through story and song and tradition. And on the other side, you have Plato, who wishes to ban poetry from his perfect republic and rationally order society as a modern socialist would approve.
I think Plato's stance on poetry is a bit conflicting because on the one hand, he seems to be saying that poets should be banned because they were impious.
Liars. They were liars as well.
They were impious. He thought that they were representing gods as being like humans.
Mm.
And this is one of the focal points where Plato is sort of beginning the tradition of monotheism, or at least paves the way towards that.
But there was also something else in it. He at one point in the Republic, he says, the poet who represents carpenter doesn't represent carpentry.
Yes.
Because he doesn't know how to do carpentry.
Yeah.
And so he relies on the ignorance of the audience to make his case. And so in a way, he's kind of concealing a lie, which is an interesting way of framing it. He's not wrong,
yeah,
that there is a kind of presumption of knowledge there that doesn't really exist.
There is this idea that the manual laborer isn't grasping the forms,
mm-hmm,
and therefore this kind of activity is less important.
Yeah.
Than an activity that would involve grasping
the ideas. The philosopher king Plato,
yeah,
potential philosopher king, thinks that philosopher kings are the most important thing in the world. What a surprise. I'm just saying. Anyway, sorry, I don't want to derail things.
No, it's interesting to see also in Plato, if you want to talk about Plato, he has the dialogue called Protagoras,
mm-hmm,
where he talks about seven sages of antiquity.
Yeah.
He wasn't the only one who was talking about seven sages. And again, if we look at them, they were giving advice.
Mm.
So we could see people as giving them, they were giving advice as, you know, nothing in excess. Everything should be in moderation. Or you should prefer friends who speak the truth to you as opposed to flatterers.
Mm.
So again, we see the notion of wisdom, and if you would like sagacity when we talk about sages, as being linked with advice that is passed on from generation to generation.
Mm.
This isn't the only way to look at it. We can start thinking of what is that kind of thing that bearers of that tradition or those who followed that tradition try to capture when they use the term wisdom. So I have a small list here. One is the notion of a skill. The other is a power of the mind. So we could say, I appeal to your wisdom, which means I appeal I appeal to the power of your mind to exercise judgment.
Yeah.
So we could try to capture either a skill that we're very proficient in using or a power of the mind to grasp something.
It seems that in the examples you've given there, there's a kind of concealed premise, though, because the wisdom, again, I can't help but feel that time is a major component of this, because why would I prefer truth-telling friends to flatterers? Because in the immediate moment, I might actually enjoy being flattered. It might be wonderful to be surrounded by flatterers, and I'd feel really good. However, obviously, the wise man would say, well, that may be true then, but in a week's time, A, these people may just leave you and you'd be left with nothing, but also they may tell you untruths that lead you to make poor decisions. And so much further down the line, you will be in a much worse condition or a much worse situation than had the good friend told you the truth at the start.
I think that's correct. And this is because one of the major messages of almost every wisdom tradition is always bear the whole in mind.
Mm.
It is not just to look for your short-term interest.
Mm.
Consider your choices, however they appeal, however they seem to you, and they appear to you, in virtue of how they are going to contribute to your whole life.
Mm.
So this is also one of the things that is told by people who are about to, right before they die, that, you know, I now realize that some of the things that I didn't value as much, I should have valued more.
I'm reminded very much of Solon and Croesus.
Yeah.
Where Croesus says, am I not the happiest man in the world? And Solon said, well, you're not dead yet.
Yes.
How can I know? As far as I'm aware, it's some wrestler in Athens who has got, you know, a bunch of children and then died in glorious battle against, you know, the enemies of the homeland or whatever. I've mentioned that story before because it sticks in my mind that this is a really wise, should I say, way of looking at whether someone is happy or not.
Yes. And
you don't know what can happen next.
Yes. And Solon was one of the seven sages.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And he was very much known for his legal work and the legal reforms that he pushed in ancient Athens.
Yeah.
And he also gave advice on mundane things and not so mundane things. Mm. This idea of advice is basically in every culture. If you could look also at, let's take a non-Western culture, like Indian culture.
Mm.
Some parts of the Vedas, the ancient text of the Vedic tradition, they contain advice about how to cook food.
Yeah.
And of how to deal with snakes.
I've actually, we'll have to do another one of these, going through a bunch of ancient texts. I've got a document that's full of links of ancient texts that are just texts about advice.
Exactly.
I mean, one of them is like the advice of an Akkadian father to his son, which I thought was really great. And it's all stuff that is basically applicable now. You know, don't consort with loose women. Don't get excessively drunk. If you see some people fighting in the street, just go the other way. Very, you know, what we would consider basic things, but timeless things. This is 4,000 years ago this was written, and I would still give this to my own son and say, follow this advice.
Yes, and actually that's quite interesting because it reminds me also of the Epic of Gilgamesh, where the whole message is don't try to be mortal, accept your nature.
Yes.
Don't try to transcend your nature because you cannot.
Yeah, except that you are going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But it's interesting how the same, surely the reason that the same wisdom is valid over such a long period of time is because the same impulses and desires keep coming up in humans, right?
Yes, I agree. And one of the main themes that wise people try to address is what we could call the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite general, but we could shed more light upon it, especially if we focus on the idea that human beings are beings who experience an inner conflict.
Mm.
The theme of a conflict between, for instance, our thoughts or reason, if you would like, and our desires or our urges is one of the most perennial themes. And it is addressed by all cultures.
Mm.
For instance, in Gilgamesh, we have a desire of Gilgamesh to be immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And we have basically wisdom that tells us otherwise.
Well, he has to travel to what are essentially the ends of the earth and speak to the antediluvian survivor Utnapishtim in order to get the sacred plant that he loses on the way back. You know.
And there is also a very profound teaching there, which, and this is how ancient texts are very holistic, in that Gilgamesh was, I think, considered as a tyrant by some of his people.
Probably.
So there's this idea that when we do not accept our nature, we end up tyrannizing people.
I think
we see that every day.
Yes. Very much so in the modern day.
Yes. So let us move a bit forward. So we focused a bit on wisdom as a power, as a skill or a power of the mind. We could also talk about wisdom as a property or a quality. So we talk about wise actions, wise words, wise
Before we move on,
decisions.
So this obviously ties very closely to Aristotle's cardinal virtue of prudence, right?
Yes.
You can't make a prudent decision if you have no wisdom by which to make a judgment.
Yes.
So this, like, sorry, go on.
No, I think he draws a distinction between wisdom and prudence.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. He does. I'm not saying that wisdom is prudence.
Yes.
But prudence kind of presupposes a stock of wisdom before you arrive at the ability to make a correct judgment. You have to have some idea of what the judgment you're making is going to produce.
I think so, yes. I think that's correct. And this is one of the aspects of Aristotle's theory that I wouldn't consider so appealing, that he has this notion of the unity of the virtues, that the virtues come as a package. If you lack one of them, you lack all of them. And if you don't possess all of them...
I do find it kind of appealing, to be honest.
Yeah?
We can discuss it in more detail another time. But yeah.
Okay. So another thing is, it can refer to a state of mind. So for instance, we say that I reached the state of wisdom, or I reached the state of nirvana, which is a kind of mental achievement. So, yeah, or we could say I reached the state of humility. In that respect, wisdom does capture a state of mind.
Yeah, I'd say so. I don't have anything to object to that.
Also, we could talk about wisdom as an excellence of character. Here is where we have a person who hasn't just made one good decision, but a question who habitually makes good decisions.
Seems to be making the case for Aristotle's unity of the virtues here.
Maybe. And one of the most pivotal notions of wisdom, or at least the things that are involved in it, is knowledge of an important body of truths. And here is where we have different kinds of wisdom, such as when we can view it when we look at different adjectives that are used, that are attached to wisdom as a noun. So we could talk about metaphysical wisdom, which is knowledge of metaphysical truths. We could talk about religious wisdom, which is knowledge of religious truth, knowledge of God, of God's will, stuff like that. We could talk also about knowledge of moral truths. And here is where theoretical wisdom parts with practical wisdom.
Yes.
Knowledge of moral truths, such as knowledge of the good life or knowledge of virtue, is considered to be practical wisdom.
Yep.
So, how would you go about thinking of wisdom? So, which of these do you like? Or, I mean, to be honest, I think all of them shed some light on the idea of a wise life and what it is to live wisely.
But I think at their roots, they all begin with a kind of humility, right?
Okay.
The idea of being able to gain wisdom or being able to learn from watching someone else's wise example begins with the premise that you actually aren't an expert in what you're doing, or there is something for you to learn. And I think that actually there are lots of people around these days who don't share that opinion. They actually disagree with that. They feel that they have mastered whatever it is that they're doing. And in their early 20s, when they come out of a university, that they are suddenly the masters of the universe and they know everything that there is to be known. And so this This is why I think that Peter Hitchens is a fringe personality in British public life, whereas you've got people like, almost anyone who's on the BBC or on Sky who give their commentary in their mid-20s, early 30s, and are treated as experts. It's like these people clearly know far less than Peter Hitchens in his 70s, and yet he's so rarely on TV.
I think this is sadly a perennial theme of every society.
Yeah.
Because wisdom involves what we said about friendship before. You have to, if you care about wisdom, I think you must have some love of human beings. Mm. So you do care, you do want to speak the truth to them. It's not just to manipulate them by an ideology that consumes them.
Yeah, it's not narcissism either.
Yes. And I think people who do this and they try to point out the uncomfortable truths, they are marginalized.
Sometimes they get Socratized.
Yes, and there's a big question here as to whether universities are doing what they should, in the sense of whether they are institutions that transmit wisdom from older generations to newer generations, or whether they have actually turned into the business of manipulating students and actually raising the voters of tomorrow, as opposed to critically minded citizens.
Sorry for coughing, but there's something going around the office and everyone's got it. That's a great question. It seems to me that in the 20th century, it may have been prior to what I the sort of rationalistic revolution in the 20th century, the universities were repositories of wisdom, where ancient traditions were kept and maintained through all sorts of strict customs and rules and norms, as well as providing the education and the subject that they wanted to transmit. But now they seem to be bastions of technical knowledge, where you read books, you receive lectures.
They are, bastions of technical knowledge, but I think that this is more on the STEM fields, because it seems to me that in the humanities, it isn't so much technical knowledge that is imparted or taught. What seems to happen there is just students are taught to find more eloquent ways to describe their condition.
Right, okay.
And there's this idea of victimization that let us all compete to write a paper that is more eloquent than others in describing how victimized we are.
See, I think that this sort of intersectional woke critical race theory perspective actually is technical knowledge. It's got quite a complex set of ideas that you have to understand. But once you do understand them, you apply them to everything without realizing it. And so it is kind of, you apply this matrix to your own mind, which is learned. You don't build up. This isn't wisdom that's being taught to people. It's a kind of brainwashing by imposing it on them.
That's an interesting point. Would you say that we could just, okay, I think that's correct. Would you say that intention matters?
Oh, completely.
And that one of the important factors here is that students are basically taught some skills, but not for the sake of empowering them, but for the sake of they are being manipulated by those who teach them those skills.
Well,
so their skills are involved, but the intention behind teaching them is not a good or virtuous intention.
I can hear Thomas's voice in my head here, telling me how critical theory was specifically designed as a method of deconstruction and nothing else. So the intent of the people who are indoctrinating students into critical theory is not to teach them any useful skills that they'd be able to use outside of the environment they're currently in, but is instead for revolutionary purposes, so it can break down defenses in order to make sure that which already exists eventually ceases to.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.